DBHDD is reminding Georgians to ask their doctor about alternatives to opioid pain medication. Alternatives such as over-the-counter medications and physical therapy can be used to manage pain. More information at opioidresponse.info.
Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Glad to have you all with us today. If you heard the opening of the show, you heard me say that Governor Kemp is right now holding a news conference that ought to be getting started about now to announce first steps in his health care proposals for the state. We're going to talk about what we know so far, little about it, and many other issues that are on the political agenda for today. Joining us, Audrey Haynes, political science professor from the University of Georgia. She also runs the Applied Political Science Program, which trains people, students, to go into careers in politics.
Yes, and a shout out to a lot of them because they are at the U.S. Capitol right now working for Cuomo, Gillibrand, Isaacson, and a whole slew of them are at the Golden Dome right now interning in a bevy of positions, and I wish them luck. They're learning a lot.
I wore an Applied Political Science T-shirt to work out in today, Audrey, because
thank you very
I knew
much.
You were going to be
yes.
here. Here are two people who can tell us whether you really want to have a career in politics or not. Sam Olens, the former Attorney General of the state of Georgia, before that the chairman of the Cobb County Commission, now an attorney at Denton's, the world's largest law firm. Hi, Sam.
Good morning, sir.
Thank
you. Good afternoon.
It's all right. That's fine. That's fine. And with him, Michael Thurman, the CEO of DeKalb County. Your credits, we could go way back. You were a legislator from Athens, is how you got your start, really.
No, actually, Bill Nygut discovered
me
on the back bench of the Georgia House of Representatives. He called me out one day, put me on WSB Channel 2. And the rest is history.
Yeah. So
thanks, Bia. It's your fault.
So for the people in DeKalb County who are not happy with you as CEO, they can call me up, tell me. But I think they probably are. It's very quiet out in DeKalb these days.
I was quiet, sitting in the back of the chamber, minding my own business, and Nygut just couldn't leave me alone.
Yeah. You know? All right. So Mike Thurman, of course, was also a state labor commissioner under Roy Barnes, Governor Roy Barnes. He ran for Senate, U.S. Senate, in 2010. You were the DeKalb County School Superintendent. You've been all over the map.
Oh, yes. And I served 8 years as Labor Commissioner during Sonny Perdue's term.
Oh, was it Sonny Perdue?
No, it was Roy.
Both of them.
Barnes the first 4 years and Governor Perdue the last 8.
All right. So let's talk. Stephen Fowler of GPB News is down at the Capitol at the news conference, but he's sending us some information on what the governor is talking about. We've waited for a long time, Sam. During the campaign, the governor made it clear he had no intention of expanding Medicaid. It was, on the other hand, Stacey Abrams' most important issue throughout the campaign. And so I think people are particularly eager to figure out just what he wants to do with this issue now, and we're getting our first indications of it. Let me, Sam, I'm going to give you first shot at this, but here's what Fowler reports. In the news conference, the governor was expected to say, of course, no chance of full expansion. He had, again, campaigned against full expansion. There will be a consultant hired at $1 million in the supplemental budget to pay for it. They're saying it's a 12 to 18-month project to research specific Georgia laws, data sets, look at other states, that sort of thing. And there is the chance that they're looking at a plan, a waiver, Sam, that would allow for supplemental payments to people who buy insurance on the exchanges, but for whom it's a long reach, as well as perhaps some expansion of Medicaid in a very limited way based on people who have behavioral or mental health issues. So what do you think when you hear the very beginnings of this?
A positive. I mean, I appreciate the governor moving forward. I think a lot of Georgians support such action. I'm reminded of the efforts of the Georgia Chamber and their research and their reports with regard to needing to really help rural hospitals. And I hope this bodes well for the health of our state.
Mike?
Absolutely. And you mentioned it, but some credit obviously goes to Stacey Abrams, who carried the flag as well as others on the progressive spectrum, who long advocated for an expansion of medical coverage for Georgians who are currently uninsured. It's a step in the right direction. And even though I would predict that the governor's incremental step, once considered by the House and the Senate, will expand, because there's always energy and impetus to covering more people with various needs and or illnesses. So it's a step in the right direction, a long time coming, and I agree with Sam, very good for the state of Georgia.
Well, and I would just follow up that there are always a couple of dimensions to this. You know, one is the good governing dimension. Of course, it's a problem, and they are recognizing it, and they're attempting at least incrementally and carefully to do something about it. And I would say it's more likely to stick if they do invest the time and effort and reach some consensus. On the other side, there's this political dimension. When you look at what establishment high-ranking politicians are saying about covering people who have pre-existing conditions, access to insurance, it is a smart political move to co-opt that issue away from Democrats, because Democrats use it very effectively in elections.
So let me weigh in with one more piece of information. Within the last 20 minutes, the governor's office put out a news release. First of all, they're calling this the Patients First Act. It's going to be introduced by the governor's floor leader in the Senate, Senator Blake Tillery, who's from Vidalia. And here's a quote from Kemp. The Patients First Act is a step toward lowering insurance premiums, enhancing access to quality care, and improving health outcomes in every part of the state. By working with other leaders, Lieutenant Governor Duncan, Speaker Ralston, and the legislature, will craft a Georgia-centric health care system that ensures a bright and healthy future for all Georgians, no matter their future, no matter their zip code. But Mike Thurmond, you know, a couple of interesting observations. Number one, we just heard Audrey say this is an incremental step. We have no reason to believe that the governor is planning on finding ways to expand Medicaid in increasing increments over the next 4 years. His people have made it clear over and over again that any kind of expansion will be very limited. And so to say that this takes an issue away from Democrats in 2020, I'm not sure is correct.
Well, yes, but to Audrey's point, I thought when what she really was describing was triangulation, which was made famous by Bill Clinton. And when you really think about it, much of 2018 was a referendum on healthcare in Georgia. And major segments of the voting population spoke very loudly that this is an issue that they do support. And I think it is a defensive move by Governor Kemp, by the Republicans, recognizing that unless they actually take some affirmative step, the clamor will grow, and they will continue as Republican leaders to be on the defensive on this issue.
Well, that may be, but Sam, if it is very, very limited in terms of the waiver for expansion, then Democrats will continue to pound away at Governor Kemp. They've made it clear they're going to have an aggressive posture toward him in all matters, and Medicaid expansion will certainly be one of them.
So look, first of all, Governor Deal sought to consider an expansion, but at the time the Obama administration had a five-year out that they unilaterally could either agree to the previously approved plan or it was out. It was only their plan as passed in the ACA. That was a killer. With regard to Governor Kemp, his plan apparently would assess somewhere between, 600 and 800,000 Georgians. That's not a small number. I mean, that's a sizable amount of our population, of our adult population, that needs that protection.
We haven't seen that number yet. If you have, I'm not aware that he's gotten that to that point yet. But
there's been some discussion whether it's accurate, inaccurate. It's a sizable number from what I've seen so far. I think the other issue is, with regard to the CEO's comment, the fact that the Republican Party spent so much time to solely repeal the Affordable Care Act with not protecting pre-existing conditions, I thought was far worse when it came to the 2018 election results. So I think from a policy perspective, you know, you can't just every day say we fell one vote short because Senator McCain switched votes. You have to give those folks that need the protection that protection.
Audrey, to reinforce your feeling that perhaps this is taking an issue away from Democrats as we approach the 2020 cycle, is that time frame for the consultant 12 to 18 months. That means that anywhere from a year to now, from now, when we really are starting to ramp up the elections of 2020, or even 18 months from now, which will put us even closer to the elections, they're suggesting they're going to have something they can roll out that may take the issue away from Democrats.
It may. And, you know what, let me just put a little context to this. You know, words matter. And when it comes to policy, you would be so surprised at how many people really do not have a lot of information. We make a lot of assumptions, but if it's in a soundbite, if we say we're doing it, that's all they need. That's what they accept. That's how they will buy in, especially if, you know, it doesn't take a lot to move public opinion sometimes because these issues are very complex and complicated. There's a lag time between when people learn about them. Think about how much money is spent in an election to drive home one point. But now you have the governor talking about it. You have people talking about it. It's going to be in the legislature. They're going to start associating movement on health care generally with, oh, the Republicans are doing something about that. And if the Democrats don't push back and frame it in a way that is simple and understandable and penetrates all the noise, then they may actually co-opt that issue.
Well, the downside is this. You've crossed the Rubicon. If 2 years from now we have the same number of Georgians uninsured, then you will be exposed as a political hypocrite.
Mm-hmm.
The other point that's very important is that he is not only committed himself, but he's committed the entire Georgia Republican Party. So Republicans who may be in conservative or districts that are threatened will now have to own this come 2020.
And that is important. And I do want to say, when they do it, you know, for in the short run, it works. But if you don't do something about the problem, there can be a backlash.
You know, in a prior show, I mentioned that Governor Kemp and I were at a Galeo meeting, Georgia Association of Latino Elected Officials. We were the only two there, and that we took a lot of grief for it, but it was the right thing to do. If you look at the governor's judicial nominating committee, and if you look at his Georgia First Committee, it is replete with minority citizens of our state, more so than I've ever seen in our state before. Asian Americans, Hispanic Americans, African Americans. This governor on his initial
rollout
is doing what few said the Republican Party should do, and he, in fact, is way in the lead in that regard. He won't get credit for it by definition, but he deserves credit for it.
He should get credit for it, but who should really get credit for it are the thousands, tens of thousands who went out and voted in November and spoke at the ballot box. Voting does matter.
Mm-hmm.
And if enough people can vote for what is right, politicians, no matter what the stripe or party, will respond to it.
Go ahead, finish your night. I apologize.
That is very true.
Wait, Sam, why do you say that he won't get credit for it? What's your point there?
Because as much as a Republican seeks to promote diversity, cheap shots will still follow. You're only doing it due to the electorate. You're only doing it because you didn't have a choice.
Are you saying that specifically in regard to how, say, the media covers the Republican Party and minorities? Because certainly the media, by the end of his second term, praised Nathan Deal for having accomplished an awful lot. I just want to make sure
And he received quite a few votes, probably from some people who are Democrats or leaning independents, too.
And Democrats, this one in particular, noted and acknowledged his work in a more broader context.
I'm just saying that in our state, there are plenty of white male leaders who talk diversity but don't do it. And this new governor is doing it with his pick of appointments to date, big time.
So this news conference underway right now comes on the same day that we're getting some interesting reporting, Sam Olens. Kevin McCarthy, went to see his doctor at some point, and in talking with his doctor, made it clear that he believes that 2018 was all about health care and Republicans lost because of health care. Your reaction to that?
Well, as I said before, I think the whole idea that we're going to repeal the ACA without anything else in its place was absolutely foolish.
Yes, and with Kevin McCarthy, I think that there is some animosity between him and the Freedom Caucus. And the Freedom Caucus is, you know, one of the culprits of a lot of that activity, pulling their party, to the right on some of those issues, too, especially regarding health care.
And I don't think it takes away from anyone, elected official or not, who responds to voter sentiment. That doesn't undercut the value.
That's democracy.
That is democracy, right. That's the way it should work. And the politicians should be sensitive and responsive to voter sentiment, and they speak at the voting box. That doesn't undermine the value of what Governor Kemp is doing. It just says he's a good politician, which doesn't negate the fact, you know, that he is doing it to protect and preserve. It's not that he's immoral for doing it. He's just a politician. We all are.
And sometimes doing the right thing is the right political move, too.
Absolutely.
All right, let's move on. Stephen Fowler may or may not, depending on his deadlines for filing for GPB Radio, call in at the end of the show to tell us a little bit more about the governor's news conference. So we'll wait to see if that unfolds or not. But in the meantime, Audrey, we think we're now getting reporting that suggests that the conference committee dealing with border security, the Trump money, now only $1.3 billion, the number of beds that ICE will have to hold undocumented immigrants, all of that is coming closer and closer. They're having a couple of interesting problems. One of them, apparently, is over whether or not federal contractors who lost pay during the shutdown are, in fact, going to be compensated. Employees already are. But the other is over the Defense of Women Act, which expires. It expired actually before the last shutdown. The Republicans are pushing for a temporary short-term extension. And interestingly enough, the Democrats are saying, no, we want a full-blown long-term extension and don't want to accept anything less. So that's where they seem to be. The House really is hoping that they're going to be able to vote by tomorrow night because they need to get it to the Senate and finished by Friday, right?
Yes, yes. So, you know, one thing I would mention with all of that information that you provided, this is one of the reasons that you have a deliberative legislative branch. When you put such a short-term deadline and you force this type of discussion to legislate so quickly, it's very difficult. In my view, they should have focused on the appropriations, Homeland Security, that should have been focused upon. And, you know, so all of these other dimensions, these roadblocks, these discussions are problematic, and they really should take place out of that appropriations. Really, even border security should be done with long-term investment, and they should build in transaction costs that, you know, where people are really involved so that it will, again, stick. And let me just say, everything that I have heard so far about this deal, if I were President Trump, I'd be pretty happy. Because when you evaluate what is going on here, it doesn't seem like the Democrats are getting a lot out of this. You know, he may be getting less money than he asked for, but he is getting money. That the ICE bed situation, they're talking about no cap. So it really is not something that fundamentally does anything real. It's an interesting idea. They're also talking about constraints on, you know, where the wall can be located, environmental concerns, but they're not getting anything long term in terms of like a DACA relief. So, I mean, it could be very easily spun by the Trump administration that this was a win for us.
So, okay, given what Audrey just said, The president doesn't like the deal, but he's apparently decided he's not going to hold back. He's not going to veto it. He'll approve it. He doesn't want another shutdown. And Republican members of the Georgia delegation, Sam, are kind of some are in a wait and see. David Perdue says, I'm not sure I want to hear more about what they're going to decide. He wants to wait to hear what the president thinks about all of this. Tom Graves has said he hasn't signed off on the reported deal. He's the only Georgian who's been part of this conference committee. Jody Heiss says he's still waiting for the final text. Johnny Isaacson spokespeople say he's probably going to support it. So all that said, is this a vote that will produce any kind of winner or loser for any member of Congress from Georgia? Or are voters going to shrug and say, fine, whatever they did?
Well, look, as far as Johnny Isaacson, he's going to do what he thinks is right for Georgia and our country. I think that's shown in the statement that you just referenced. And I think it's going to pass. And then I think the question is, after it passes and the president signs it, are he and the speaker going to be able to get together in a room and work on some other legislation that our country needs? As an aside, I apologize, but since we're here live,
it's fine.
Your friend Greg Bluestein's new article with Ariel Hart references an audit covering as many as 535,000 newly eligible Georgians would join under his plan.
Oh, we're going back to this is Bluestein reporting
and Ariel Hart
reporting out of the news conference.
Yes. So they're saying 535,000 new Georgians, along with 40,000 who are now eligible. So under Greg and Ariel's article, it would be 575.
Okay,
that's a sizable number.
And that's
I apologize. I went back, but
no, that's fine. That's fine. No. Thank you for reporting that, and I look forward to reading that whole article.
Can I just mention too, back to the wall?
What do you?
Oh yeah.
Let's try to stay organized for a minute.
If only the controversy and the shutdown had really been about border security, but it wasn't. It was politics. And I think if you just look at it as a raw political equation, unvarnished, the president lost because he made it a position where it's my wall or nothing. And what members of the Republican Party in the House and the Senate and the Democratic Party said that that's not the path that we're going to travel on. That's why he seems a little ambiguous about even and disappointed in the outcome, because he should be. It was an all or nothing proposition. You said it's a deliberative body. It's also one of compromise, right? No one gets everything that he or she might want. So looking at it now, whether you're Republican or Democrat, you could send out an email blast to your constituents and say, hey, we won.
Well,
you have stated that I want $5 billion or nothing.
Oh, you know, and I don't disagree. But what I would say is he's likely going to spin it as a win anyhow. And, you know, if we look at that 55 miles of wall, that's $25 million per mile. I mean, it's a lot of money when we have a $22 trillion budget deficit. And, you know, he may spin it as a win, but it's going to have political ramifications. And I don't think it helps the Republican Party.
I may have been naive, but when I looked at the issue, I thought, you know, they need a wall and more electronic surveillance and more personnel. To me, that was the solution from day one, right? Any rational, reasonable person looking at a 2,000-mile border would have said, you know, you need some of both, and let's come up with a compromise that we can finance at this point in time, and let's move on to the next issue.
Yeah, data-driven, right?
Yes.
Where do we need both.
Of course you need a wall in some areas. Absolutely. But at the border crossings, you really need more personnel.
That's right. The wall
won't help you at a border crossing.
So let me ask you the question that I asked Sam a few minutes ago, Mike, and then you can weigh in on this too, Audrey. Is there a price to pay for anybody in the Georgia congressional delegation, no matter how they vote on this? You can vote against the compromise, I suppose, if you're a Republican, saying we know that Trump didn't get the money he wanted, so we don't like this deal, and be fine, or you can vote for it and be fine. Is there any price to pay or no?
Well, because of the way the districts are drawn, it will negate or dilute any impact. except in one congressional district, and the incumbent has already announced that he's not running.
Yeah, that's Rob right. Woodall says, I'm not going to run for re-election.
So maybe he was the only one who could have been or would have been at risk as a result of a position on the wall. The others are more or less insulated.
That maybe in the Senate, you know, the statewide races, maybe it potentially could come back to haunt them, but they're all safe in their primaries.
All right. Well, we're going to wait and see if the House and the Senate are able to get this done. They've got until midnight Friday night. And will if other Georgia legislators up there weigh in on this, we'll certainly talk about what they've decided to do on Friday's show. Let me turn to another. You know what? We better get a break out of the way. I just looked at the clock. Time's a-wasting. We need to get a break in. Let's do that. We'll come back with a lot more. I want to look at some local issues that this panel is really well-positioned to talk about. This is Political Rewind.
Financial contributions from listeners like you are not the only gifts that keep GPB on the air. In fact, many listeners have already chosen to donate a used vehicle to GPB. We'll pick up your vehicle for free and send you the paperwork for your taxes. Get started today. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or go to gpb.org/cars. That's 877-GPB-1-CAR or gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
In the years since the Parkland shooting, one survivor is still trying to find balance in her life.
It's very hard to have a normal high school experience while we still go to Stoneman Douglas, and that's just what the reality is.
She's class president, but she's also the outreach director for March for Our Lives. Her story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
4 till 7 today on GPB and gpbnews.org.
Michael Thurman, African American community, particularly here in Georgia, has been for a very long time tried to call attention under the leadership of Tyrone Brooks, former state representative, who has for years and years pushed for law enforcement, FBI, state law enforcement, to reopen the case of the Moores Ford Bridge lynchings. Without going into great detail, two African-American couples who lived in that community, they were having a dispute with a white landlord out that way, according to all of the reporting. And there was some violence involved in the dispute, and the two couples were taken by someone, never identified, to an area near the bridge and shot and murdered, right? I got the basics of that correct?
Yes, the person who actually took him there was identified because he went on their bond. He got them out of jail and delivered them to be murdered.
In 2000, and there's a reason we're bringing it up now, and Sam, please jump in here, and Audrey. In 2007, Greg Bluestein, who is not here because he's down at that news conference, when he was still with the Associated Press, got a hold of FBI reporting and reported that at the time the FBI was investigating, so sometime in the late 40s, they believed it was possible that then-Governor Eugene Talmadge may have had a role in goading the killers on because he wanted a racial incident like that. He was probably one of Georgia's most racist governors to help him win re-election. And he did, by the way, win Walton County. So that was 2007. It's never been proven, but the reason we bring it up to date now is that a federal court has just ruled that all of the grand jury testimony surrounding the Moores Ford Bridge investigation now must be released. How important is that?
It's extremely important that all of the record as it exists is made available for public scrutiny. Now, we don't know yet whether or not the governor actually participated, but we do know that in the history of Georgia politics and Southern politics, that it was standard operating procedure to raise racial tensions in the midst of elections in order to advance the political careers of racist segregationist politicians. If, in fact, it occurred, it would not have been an unusual event. It happened, and it's not just race. It was also anti-Semitism. Those things were standard fare for Georgia politics. So I think it's important. I want to thank Tyrone Brooks for and the local. I've been to the Moores Ford event over the years, and for the local leaders who have not and should not ever discontinue their advocacy, trying to, number one, get the truth out, and if any of the perpetrators are still alive, they should be brought to justice. Just an aside, my parents lived on the other side of the Broad River in Oconee County in the High Shoals area. After the lynching, they moved to Clark County, Athens, where I was born.
Out of fear.
Out of fear. Large percentages of the black population in Oconee County after that lynching left Oconee County, basically depopulated it to a great extent in terms of African Americans, and moved to an urban area, which was Athens.
Okay, so Sam, I think we should say there's a really strong parallel in the county that you spent so many years working as a commission chair in, when Leo Frank, the Jewish businessman, was lynched in Marietta, accused of a murder of a young factory worker who was in his employ. A similar exodus took place with Jewish families in Atlanta, who no longer felt safe living in Atlanta. I didn't want to get too far from Moore's Ford Bridge, but that's an important parallel to bring to light right now.
Look, similar to the issue with Stone Mountain, you should never seek to erase history, and you should always seek to learn from history. There's no question in my mind, and I presume we would all agree, that the grand jury record should be released. It has been 72 years. It is more than time to release all that information. And if one of the arguments counter release is you could cause other people to be in danger, well, the Cobb experiences you referenced, Bill, what happened was some of the leading families in Cobb County and Marietta in particular were involved in the lynching. They were the first ones to come forward and say, oh, my God, it's terrible. What my relatives did, it was totally wrong. Yeah. No defense. Absolutely atrocious. And everyone was very thankful for their comments. So I think if you're literally looking to help ease the pain, you release the records.
One of the people, by the way, up there, as you know full well, Sam, who came forward was Roy Barnes, whose wife, Marie, was the granddaughter of one of the leaders of that lynch mob. And Barnes was very straightforward. He came forward at any number of occasions to say that this was something that the family needed to be willing to expose.
Chuck Clay's family, yeah. Otis Brumby's family, there were no shortage of leading Marietta citizens involved. But the important thing was they all said how sorry they were for it. That's the appropriate statement. That's the way that you help heal the community. You don't hide it. I mean, my God, it's 72 years. Let's cover it in detail once and for all.
And don't appreciate the importance of Jewish leaders like Sam and others who were in positions of influence when all of this unfolded and how they managed and responded to the situation.
Audrey, I know that many people in this state have never heard of Moore's Ford Bridge before.
You read my mind.
Right. But it has been an enormous, but nevertheless, for those who are aware of it, it's been an enormous stain ever since it occurred and ever since no one was ever brought to justice for those crimes. It's been an enormous stain on this state.
No, and I would say it's heartbreaking in so many ways. And I would bring this back to young people and others. There is such a high level of ignorance as to what has come before, a lack of knowledge. In fact, most people don't know how many lynchings have occurred in the South. They don't recognize how many young people, teenagers, 14, 15, 16 years old, were lynched by mobs. How many children watched this happen because it was treated almost like a social event. And that is a stain, too. So many of the students I teach, we do a segment on this area, and they are, you watch them as they see the documentaries and pictures, and they don't believe that that could happen. But it hasn't been that long, right?
We are not certain that the Justice Department could very well appeal this ruling, Sam. You, of course, have made it clear you hope they don't, and that you would like to see these transcripts come forward and be made public.
Absolutely. Sense. I mean, there were an awful lot of lynchings in the Southeast.
Oh, absolutely.
And any and all government records on any and all of those lynchings need to be presented to the public.
There's an amazing museum now that has documented the lynchings that occurred throughout the United States of America. I spoke with representatives from the DeKalb NAACP who came to visit me 2 weeks ago, Teresa Hardy, with a request that we establish markers for lynchings that occurred in DeKalb County.
Right. And I was going to say, you cannot understand the feelings and the fear that some of your colleagues in life have, because they have lived under that kind of fear, right? I mean, if you can't understand how an African American in your state can respond when they hear that. When you approach that, their feelings in a way where you don't have compassion, empathy, or understanding.
Mike, I believe that you're talking about the new lynching memorial in Montgomery.
I believe there are
DeKalb County lynchings that are memorialized as part of that.
Yes.
I believe that they're offering counties like yours the opportunity to have something that comes out of the memorial to bring back with you to your county, so your own citizens can see. Right? Am I right?
You're absolutely right. And myself and the county commissioners, we are 100% in support of that effort. One of the things Audra mentioned, I grew up with that fear. I remember the Lemuel Penn murder.
Tell everybody what that
Lemuel Penn was. African-American man, a former military veteran who came through Athens, Georgia, and a group of Klansmen shot and killed him in Madison County. I remember that. I remember the fear. It's not ancient history. Mm-hmm. It's history that everyone that in this room may have lived at some point in time. But the key is to learn from it. You can't learn from it if you hide it. We can learn from what happened at Moores Ford.
All right,
and we can help teach people not to harbor racist views and to perpetrate and seek to do violence to people you don't know, respect, or
and
understand.
With that in mind, you've given me a perfect transition. There was a time you spent some time in your role, not only as CEO of the county, but also as a member of the board of the Stone Mountain Park Commission
Mountain Memorial Association.
And there have been efforts that have been ongoing to try to do something. If not, we seem to have moved away from saying, let's get rid of the carvings on the side of the mountain. There are some who would still like that to happen. But increasingly, thanks to some efforts on your part, there has been an effort to, in fact, also pay tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King at the park, since we remember his words in the speech, "Let Freedom Ring," from Stone Mountain. And now the Republican Attorney General of the state, who's going to be a guest on this show on Friday, Chris Carr, first Republican statewide elected official, to my knowledge, who's come out and said, let's do something. Let's put the bell tower on top of the mountain. Good idea?
Great idea. I talked to Chris late last week, and I thanked him for the courage to speak the truth and to hopefully bring other members of his party and other people who may feel differently forward to recognize that Stone Mountain Park it's owned by the taxpayers of the state of Georgia. That's all of us. Mm-hmm. There's a sign as you enter the park that says, welcome to the people's park. Welcome to your park, right? It belongs to all of us. We should have an inclusive narrative. One thing he said at addition is not subtraction.
Yeah. Well, this is exactly what you were saying, mm-hmm. Sam Olens. We cannot erase history. We have to expand history.
No, absolutely. And look, Chris was 100% right. Not only is he very well read, he's also very well learned through his experience working with Senator Isaacson. And I certainly applaud him for his action, but it's also my understanding that at this year's program on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, his talk resonated way before he started talking about the bell tower at Stone Mountain Memorial Park. He talked about how all of Georgia needed to come together and recognize that the brilliance of MLK. And there were a lot of folks that are members of Ebenezer that came away that day being Chris Carr fans.
Well, Heath Garrett has spoken, too. You mentioned Senator Isaacson, but Heath has also
regular
spoken
up. Regular panelist
on
our show.
One of the panelists here. So he's spoken up in support as well. But Bia, tie Stone Mountain to Moores Ford.
Yeah.
They're connected.
Yeah.
The Martin Ku Klux Klan was reborn at Stone Mountain. That whole effort to reestablish... Go ahead, Bill.
Because we're going to make another connection. Not only is Moores Ford Bridge connected to Stone Mountain, but so is the founding of the Klan to what happened in Marietta, Georgia, when Leo Frank was lynched, because it was in the aftermath of Leo Frank's lynching, right, Sam, that the modern Klan was born on top of Stone Mountain. All those connections come together in this conversation.
Which is why... And people look at some of them. If we tell the truth around some of the monuments, then we can learn from it. We will be heartbroken to know the truth. There's not a historical marker that designates Stone Mountain as the birthplace of the Martin Ku Klux Klan.
Yes, and children, the children of our future, deserve the right to see everything and
you
to
know,
learn from it.
I'm reminded of Herman Russell's autobiography that talked about how MLK at various times and his family could not sleep at their house for fear that it was going to be put on fire by the Klan. And the trials and tribulations of him having his mission and keeping his family safe. I think young people also don't realize the simple day in and day out fear of African-American leadership that sought to say we could have a better world.
And when we talk about lynching, I just got to say this, Bill. It was not just black victims. Mm-hmm. If you think about the three civil rights workers in Philadelphia, Mississippi, one was Jewish, one was white, and then one African-American, Viola Liozzo, all of these individuals.
A white woman who went to march in Selma to march.
And white men who tried to help others. There are a couple of instances where they were lynched, too.
There are these tiny little things that remind us how sensitive our past can be and how much we have to be conscious of it at all times, Audrey. And I mention this now because Drew Ferguson it was reminded of that in an incident that took place in his office just this week. Mm-hmm. He had visitors from a federal labor union who came to see him about an issue, and they noticed that on display, among other memorabilia in the office, was a biography of General Robert E. Lee, soldier, citizen, and Christian patriot. And they were offended to see that book in a congressman's collection of memorabilia. But what happened?
Well, what happened is Drew Ferguson was very mortified by that and apologized at least 15 times. We were listening on CNN where he was addressing it again. I did talk to someone who has
and
worked,
he took they took
yes,
the book
and
off
they got,
the shelf
and, yes,
immediately.
Washington's hair. There's a lock of Washington's hair there, and it's still there. But but it just tells you, when you are a public figure— And you have you should recognize that some of the things that you may have on display can be harmful or hurtful. But at the same time, maybe there was an overreaction.
Thurmond apparently doesn't think you're a historian. You think that book shouldn't have been taken off the shelf?
Well, I've read books dealing with Confederate history. Let me just be clear, right? I mean, you can't really study and write about the Civil War unless you spend some time reading and researching about
the Confederacy. Well, there's between reading a book and putting it out on display, perhaps.
Well,
all right.
It's in my library. But let me tell you one thing I've learned from about Robert E. Lee.
Yeah.
He was the one who advocated abolishing slavery and allowing black Southerners to fight. The Confederate Congress opposed it and consequently led to the demise of the South, which was a great thing.
Michael Thurman, you got the last word in that segment. We got to get to another break. When we come back, we've got a lot more to still talk about.
on the next Fresh Air, how Russian-style kleptocracy has infiltrated the U.S. We talk with Franklin Foer, national correspondent for The Atlantic. We'll also discuss the latest news about the Mueller investigation and Paul Manafort. Foer's article about Manafort is nominated for a National Magazine Award. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 here on GPB, and you can listen online at gpbnews.org.
Touchdown, John Nelson here from GPB Sports, reminding you that in Georgia, the four seasons are not winter, spring, summer, and fall. It is football, spring football, Cruton, and National Signing Day. On the Football Fridays in Georgia podcast, we'll tell you the stories on and off the field. Subscribe at gpb.org/sports and wherever your favorite podcasts are found.
I hope you're watching on Facebook Live, because Sam Olens, who is about as, you know, as
coordinated
up as you can, well, there was that, but also about as buttoned up a political leader as you can get, was rocking out to the music in that break. That was wonderful to watch, Sam. I can't wait to see you at the next bar mitzvah we both go to. All right. So Sam Olens is here. Michael Thurman is here. Audrey Haynes from the University of Georgia is here. I want to tell you, in the opening of the show, I said we were going to talk about David Ralston warning his fellow Republicans that they better be careful about how far to the right they go, because if they go too far to the right, they're going to continue to lose ground in North Metro Atlanta. I'm going to park that conversation and bring it into Friday's show. Okay?
Because, but I'm not here Friday.
Okay. Let's move on, because you and Sam particularly can talk about something that I think you both are really plugged into. Sam, we Charlotte Nash, the Gwinnett County chair, is going to come on the show in a couple of weeks, largely thanks to your suggesting we bring her in here. She's been a leader in this whole effort to get Gwinnett to vote to expand MARTA into their county. It's been controversial forever, and now they seem to be moving in that direction. You come from a county where they're not able to move that way or haven't been able to. What do you think about what Charlotte Nash is doing up there?
Oh, I adore her. I think she's an outstanding local government leader. I think that her political skills are fantastic. I think it will, I hope, succeed to bring MARTA to Gwinnett County. It's way past time for it to be throughout our region, and it's my hope that with a coordinated campaign, everyone will be celebrating.
What did you learn in watching the problems that Cobb has had over the years in an expansion of MARTA? What can you take away from the experience there that will help inform how they succeed if they're going to in Gwinnett?
Look, I made two agreements with MARTA when I was chair. We brought MARTA into the transfer station at Cumberland Mall, and we expanded paratransit service where we let the closest paratransit vehicle take care of the individual rather than whether it was a Cobb or a MARTA vehicle. They both were unanimous votes. What I learned a long time ago was, in local government, if you actually respect your constituents and you improve the quality of life for your constituents, you'll do quite fine.
And yet it's still controversial in Cobb County, and Cobb isn't voting on bringing MARTA in.
Well, I wish they were.
Okay, I got you. Mike Thurman, your county has been part of MARTA from the very start,
mass paying into pioneers. It.
So is Gwinnett, are they going to expand it to Gwinnett, and why is that significant to all of us who don't live in Gwinnett, those of us who don't live in Gwinnett County?
Well, thank you. I celebrate the men and women of Vision who 50 years ago supported MARTA. Just think how difficult it was 50 years ago, if it's still a challenging Cobb today. And we don't celebrate them enough. They rose above race and class and did the right thing, and it's had huge positive impacts in DeKalb. What's interesting in Gwinnett are the political dynamics. It will fail or succeed primarily based on Democratic voters, right? So now, Chair Lady Nash, who's a brilliant leader, and the other Republican leaders are having to work closely with the Democratic leaders and voters to assure passage. So people like Representative Dewey McClain, Stacey Abrams was out in Gwinnett endorsing the referendum yesterday. That's what's unique and interesting for me to watch.
Mike, I couldn't pass a SPLOST without reaching out to the Democrat community and getting their support.
And that's what it comes down to. But what Mr. Olin just said, it's so difficult for some people who wear suits like we do the right thing. They'd rather lose than reach out to people who can help them win. You see it happen time and time and time again.
Okay, but again, let me ask again, if I may, why is it significant in a larger way whether Gwinnett does or doesn't vote for MARTA?
I'm on the ATL board, so I get it. It's a huge piece in terms of developing a regional transportation system. If we, and I said we, although I'm not a Gwinnett resident, but if the referendum passes, that will open up the door and make Cobb possible, I believe, or Henry County or Douglas County. So this is a key component of building this regional transportation system, and I support it, and I'm wishing them well.
You know, Audrey, it's fascinating to me that to some extent, public transit, I think, has a lot to do with your DNA. I grew up in Chicago. I lived on CTA buses on the L when I go to New York. When I used to take my children to New York, to London, to Paris, wherever, they would say to me, "Wow, this is so wonderful! We get to go everywhere on a subway." And so I get it. If you've grown up here in Georgia, you're a little less likely to understand why it's such a great freeing thing to have public transit.
Well, plus you love your car and you think your car is the freeing thing. And you have suburbs built around cars. I mean, the neighborhood I live in, we don't even have sidewalks. I guess you drive to your next door neighbor's house.
just to have children that are teenagers or older, they get it.
Yeah.
They want the expanded transit. And guess what? Those companies that the millennials are going to work for, they want the transit.
All right. We are really just about out of time, but I didn't want to miss the opportunity to have two county leaders sitting at the table to mention Gwinnett and hear your thoughts about it. That early voting on that referendum, I think, begins right at the end of this month, right before Charlotte Nash comes in. She'll be here on a show in about 2 weeks. So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
Absolutely. And one thing I encourage all leaders to do is to make decisions that 50 years from now, people will look back and say, "That was brilliant."
Yes. All right. Amen.
That's what you really want to do.
That's Michael Thurman, the CEO of DeKalb County. Sitting across from him today, Sam Olens, former Attorney General of the state of Georgia, and our friend Audrey Haynes, who comes in from Athens to do this show.
Because it's so wonderful for these guys.
We're glad to have you, as you know, Audrey. Your successor, Chris Carr, Attorney General of Georgia, joins us on Friday to talk about Stone Mountain, to talk about this criminal information against, because of an Open Records Act in the city of Atlanta, a first. We'll talk to him about that as well, and we'll look at all the other top headlines in political news. See y'all Friday at 2:00.